Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking with Michael Kevney. We'll discuss his unique vision and the inspiration behind the wildly successful rustic Italian spot here in the Belmont neighborhood in Charlottesville. Also on the menu, the Cicchetti Bar, Rossi Shrimp, and possibly some cooking tips and a glimpse into some of his favorite meals to cook at home. Plus, we're looking forward to speaking with Tracy Howe, musician, activist, and founder of Restoration Village Arts, on her music and the connection between beauty and justice. We'll hear about the work Restoration Village Arts does fighting against systems of oppression and for racial justice, eco-justice, queer justice, and borderlands justice. And in just a year and a half, we have spoken to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And my good friend Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I am here in what was formerly known as the lazy days of summer. Do you remember when we used to refer to summer as the lazy days? Does it hardly feel like anything these days is lazy at all?
Not at all.
God, it's like one long day. One long, horrific Groundhog Day.
I mean, in terms of our usual schmooze here at the top of the show, I think there's nothing more to talk about other than what's going on with families at the border.
Yes, the latest formation of how to eliminate protections for asylum seekers. I mean, they are just on a tear. When I learned that they actually were transporting children in the middle of the night, posing as soccer players and dispersing them in secret, so that the mayors and the governors of the places they're going don't even know they're there. I mean, these guys are so incompetent and yet so unethical and inhumane and efficient at it. It's amazing the skill set these guys have.
Yeah, and you know, what I like to always think about is, or not think about, but to remind myself and people, is that a lot of these people are fleeing violence in their countries, and it's in direct violation of our, I guess, international treaty obligations to be treated this way, because they have the right to seek asylum. You know, they're leaving gang violence, recruitment of children into human trafficking, and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, it is illegal to penalize a refugee for the even if they don't come in at a port of entry, which I'm sure you've heard they're making that impossible anyway. But as long as, provided they properly surrender themselves, they are turning the basic protections into a criminal, making a misdemeanor, a felony. You know, they're indicting all these people.
Meanwhile, they don't process
felonies for all the White House staff that continues to, you know, not fill out their forms correctly. You don't see them being separated from their kids, you know, and going to prison.
Good point. Yeah, and the executive order, you know, just trying to fix something that Trump caused in the first place did not do anything. It's not a solution. It doesn't reunite all these children. I think 2,300 and growing.
What is it up to now? Yeah, it's up to 3,000.
3,000 who have already been separated and are whisked away, as you said, to places all over the country. The International Rescue Committee vice president said that, the name is Hans von der Weerd, said the administration is replacing one form of cruelty with another. Central American children and their families have suffered enough. And there's reporting by Jacob Soboroff. I heard him on MSNBC, who said that basically everything Trump's saying is a lie, of course, as usual, and it's so far removed from reality. And that if he was only reading the Drug Enforcement Administration reports that say that spillover violence doesn't happen, drugs come through legal ports of entry, and the young people that he's always accusing of MS-13 are not, and that it's as safe as can be on the U.S. side, despite the violence on the other side.
Yeah, the fact that they refuse to show pictures the pictures they're showing, who knows if they're current, who knows, but the fact that they're just so not transparent about the pictures just makes you wonder, speaking of the trauma, what is it really that they're doing to these kids? And also it's also the family, it's the parents too. I know they're older and their brains have formed farther, but it's just all of this trauma. And I feel like even the kids in this country, we all feel it. So they're feeling it too. Everyone's, that's what I mean.
I know.
Lazy days of nothing.
And there was a great, great article about what we can do. Everyone's asking, I believe, what can we do? So it's a Slate article co-written by Dahlia Lithwick, who is a former Charlottesville resident and very respected law writer. It's Here's How You Can Help Fight Family Separation at the Border. Just Google the Slate article, and basically it comes down to lawyers, translators, donations, and protest. There are over 30 organizations listed and updated every day or so right there. So that's one thing. The ACLU is on the top of that list, but then there's also some other ones that you can, that were to, like, I just saw an update as of yesterday or the day before about specifically what you can do to address what's happening at this moment. There's the IRC. There's Alex Azar, the former pharmaceutical executive who heads up the HHS. You can call him at this number, 202-690-7000, and call your congressmen and women.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the HHS secretary, Rachel Maddow show just pointed out over that weekend when they started showing the pictures of those detention prison camps that they're making, and they're making more of them, that he was at Dartmouth at his college reunion.
Mm-hmm. I saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard him talking about it. It just makes you just sick.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So an event that's related is that this Sunday, so we also became aware here in this town that in Stanton, our close relative over there, over the mountain, there's a Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center detention center that is basically, there are abuse claims there of children, said that they've been beaten and all this. So there's a Stop Torturing Children rally in Stanton tomorrow, the 24th of June at 10 a.m. Until We Are Done is what it says. And you can find information about that all over. CRAC is the Citizen Action Network, or actually the Charlottesville Area Immigrant Resource Advocacy. There's a lot of letters and names, but
that's great.
You can find it if you look.
That is great. There's also a nationwide protest against his family separation policy on June 30th. The main demonstration is in D.C., but they are all over the country, and that's familiesbelongtogether.org.
Yeah, thank you. So on a different note, a very interesting and diverse show we have for you today. Our first guest is Michael Kevney. Michael is the executive chef and owner of Tavola, the very successful Italian restaurant in Charlottesville. His unique vision and the inspiration behind it, we will discuss. Also, hopefully, the Cicchetti Bar and some cooking tips and a glimpse into some of his favorite meals. We're giving him a hint as to what we might ask. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you opened your restaurant in 2009, and it really has been a hit ever since, I believe. So it's getting busier and busier. What was your vision for bringing Italian food to Virginia, specifically in Charlottesville?
Well, I think that at the beginning, it wasn't even going to be an Italian restaurant. As a chef, I had all these different cuisines that I loved to cook. And my wife convinced me that Italian would be a good way to go, that this market could use a good rustic Italian restaurant. And that kind of reminded me that that's what I love to cook, and that's what I cook at home very often. And I kind of thought about it and woke up one morning and said, all right, let's do an Italian restaurant. And it became a lot easier from there to have a vision, because I'd had a focus and started putting together all these recipes that I wanted to do. We were slated to open in spring, so I had the springtime menu and got everything going. And, you know, of course, you wake up one day and it's July, and we're ready to open the restaurant, and I realized that my menu was kind of spring, so had to sit down in the last minute and rewrite the menu. And, yeah, when we opened, we were very busy, and my philosophy on that was, you know, there's what's called the honeymoon period in restaurants, where when you open, everyone tries it, and there's this big boon of business, and then it kind of settles in. And I never believed in that. I think that when you have everyone try your restaurant, that's your chance to make a first impression and get them back. So we started out very focused on being prepared right from the get-go and providing a great experience, you know, to get all those people to become regulars. And I think we did that very successfully from the beginning.
So, Michael, what is your background? Where were you trained? How did you get here?
Well, I've been in the restaurant business going on over 35 years, I think 37 years. I started as a dishwasher and just worked my way up where I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood, which... So the first restaurant I worked at was an Italian restaurant in Hartford, Carbone's, very popular, successful restaurant there. From there, I went all over New England. Every summer, I would go somewhere different and cook, Nantucket, Block Island, Newport, Rhode Island, and then decided to go to school. I went to the Culinary Institute in New York, Culinary Institute of America. And then after graduating, moved to San Francisco and cooked there for several years, and then Napa, and moved back east to New York, just east of the city, and got married, had a child, and me and my wife decided to settle in Charlottesville.
So how would you describe, speaking of being married, the marriage of Italy and Charlottesville? What do you do different or maybe the same to bring that cuisine here?
Well, when I talk about what Tavola is, it's an Italian restaurant, but it's Italian in philosophy. It's not a regional Italian. And I like to, what I mean by philosophically is in Italy, they cook what's available to them. They cook what's locally produced, and that really dictates the menus. And so opening an Italian restaurant here in Charlottesville, I wanted to have that same philosophy and use what's available in Charlottesville. We don't have veal growing in this area. We have a lot of pigs, so we have a pretty pork centric restaurant as an example.
Mm-hmm. And what would you, so if the, as Ellen said, it's the combination of the two places, how would you describe the cuisine?
The cuisine is really rustic and simple and approachable, and I think that that's part of the reason for our success. I like to stick with four or five ingredients, and that really relies on the balance and the skill of the person preparing it, so that these ingredients come together and are, you know, the end result is greater than the sum of its parts, that old phrase. And I think that, you know, that's very Italian. We find the best ingredients that we can, and we don't manipulate them very much. We treat them with respect and simply prepared.
So another ingredient that I think you were looking for that became a signature dish of yours, I wonder if you could talk about Rossi shrimp and how that became a signature dish.
Yes, the shrimp Rossi was... I kind of came up with this dish years back. My grandmother, who me and her had a very strong food connection, she moved to Florida. This is in New England. She moved to Florida, and when we talk on the phone, she would always complain about the seafood in Florida not being anywhere near as good as New England. So by this time, I was cooking in a restaurant, and this was a pretty cool restaurant, kind of ahead of its time in Hartford, where the chef was coming up with a menu every day and changing the menu, and he would bring in a fish every day. And so this, my grandmother was coming to visit. This one day, he had salmon on the menu, but when the salmon arrived, he wasn't thrilled with the quality, sent it back. And I said, my grandmother's coming here. She wants seafood. You're kidding me. We have no seafood on the menu. And he said, well, pull a box of shrimp, come up with a dish. So I did. And I started with the basic scampi, garlic butter, white wine. And then I had this gorgonzola butter that we were drizzling over a steak. And I added a ladle of that and some capers and tomatoes. And really what came out was this really nice dish, a lot of flavor, a lot of balance. And it was the first time that I had created a dish that people were buying and enjoying, and I was getting compliments on it. My grandmother, of course, loved it and kept the menu, and it was called Shrimp Rossi, which is her maiden name, and, framed it and put it on her wall. But at the same time, the chef kept it on the menu for several weeks, and it became really popular, and it gave me the instant gratification that being a chef gives you, and it made me want to be a chef. So it's a very important dish in my development. And to this day, every restaurant that I've worked at or been, a chef at, I've put on the menu. And it is a good example of really relying on all those ingredients in balance. You take away one ingredient, and it throws the whole thing off, which is why on our menu we say we don't substitute things. We like to kind of keep them the way that we developed them, and it's really important.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the ingredients that are important each season, do you tweak the menu for what is available in Virginia? I'll just leave it at that.
We do, yeah. So each season we change. We have a seasonal pasta. The fish dish will change. And some of the most of the vegetable dishes, side dishes will change. But, the core menu remains the same because those are the dishes that really drive our success. One of my restaurant philosophies is to create a craving that only you can satisfy. So when people, if they've had our carbonara or our bolognese, they're thinking about it, that's the next day at the water cooler, they can't go somewhere else and satisfy that craving. They have to come back to Tavola. So that's one of the ways in which, we get people back in.
So, go ahead,
what
Nance.
What is on your specials board right now?
Oh, the specials board is a nice, it's a nice part of our what we do at Tavola, because it gives the chefs some freedom. They come up with all the specials, and we do a soup, a starter, an entree. And last night they did a slow roasted pork belly over polenta with cipollini onions and just the simple braising liquid. The night before we had a swordfish dish that Chef Dylan came up with when he first came on board last year, and it was so good that I actually let him put it on the menu for a while, and I don't give up many menu spaces for so that was so when I do, it's a good dish. And I had it again Friday night and realized, or I'm sorry, Thursday night, and realized why it was on the menu last year. It was absolutely delicious. So Chef Dylan's doing an incredible job with the specials, and that's what I pretty much eat every night.
So you're listening to Apropos of Something. Hopefully we are creating craving for more talk. We're going to talk with Tracy Howe, musician, activist, and founder of Restoration Village Arts. And we're talking right now with Michael Kevney, executive chef and owner of Tavola. We'll be right back with both of them. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Michael Kevney, the chef of Tavola. A little bit later, in a few minutes, actually, we're going to talk with Tracy Howe about her activism and Restoration Village Arts and her music, of course. So, Michael, tell us about how the restaurant started. I hear there's a story about it. May not have gone as planned.
Yeah. So I had this space all picked out and had a gentleman's agreement with the owner of the space. And when I was finally ready to move forward, I showed up and this person was not interested anymore. And I kind of freaked out a little bit and I had my back against the wall and had to figure it out. So I said, well, I'm going to go get lunch and a bottle of wine and go home and rethink this. So I went to Belmont neighborhood, went Belmont Barbecue, and I went to grab a bottle of wine at Crush Wine Shop, and they were closed because it was a Monday. And I looked in the window and in the door, and I immediately got this vision of this little restaurant and how that could work. And so I went home and I went on Craigslist and I looked up businesses for sale, and I saw a wine shop for sale. And my eyes got wide, and I called the number, and I said, is this Crush Wine Shop?
Oh, wow.
And he said, yep. And I said, all right, don't sell it. I'll be there in the morning, first thing. And I went down there, and I pitched my idea, and I got the space.
And how long were you cooking as executive chef before? I know you've mentioned another chef sometimes prepares food at your restaurants. I was just wondering, that shift to being in charge of someone, how long before that happened, and how has that been since it happened?
It's been great. I cooked for the first 2 years every night, and I was the chef and assumed all those responsibilities. And 2 years in, you know, I really had to make a decision to get a little more balance in my life. And we had a sous chef at the time that I had talked to about him taking over the reins. And he did, and it went very well. And from there, you know, I just became kind of the chef kind of mentor, but not really involved in the day-to-day operations of a chef. And so we've had three or four chefs since then, and they've all worked out really well.
Tell me a little bit more about the vision of the restaurant, your philosophy, and what you want to say about it.
So I think that really when you look at why we're so successful, I have this philosophy that, you know, anyone can have good food, good wine, but I think it's about the experience. And Tavola, and I call it the theater of dining, Tavola has this incredible vibe. And when you walk in the door, first, as you're walking up, you see in the windows, and we have nice lights in the windows, and you see this action and these crowds and people at the tables, and you walk in and you're immediately met with sights, smells, you know, the noise of guys in the kitchen, whether it's food sizzling in a pan or chopping or pounding. You know, we do our carpaccio to order. We pound the meat thin, and to the Yelp person that thought we were doing our prep work on the line and pounding veal, which, as I said, is not on the menu. Mm-hmm. No, we actually pound our beef carpaccio to order because that's the best way to present it. So there's all, you know, there's all these, all your senses are being kind of tantalized at the same time. And, you know, the music, the lighting, all the vibe, all kind of contribute to the vibe. The staff, I have an incredible staff. They're very committed. They're very passionate. They're very happy to do what they do, and they're very good at what they do. And so all these things kind of on a nightly basis really contribute to our success. And it's kind of an amazing thing. It's kind of performance art in a sense where, you know, if you knew all day what goes into this, you know, I'll walk in and, you know, the dishwasher is leaking. We got a repairman in there. The Osobuco showed up frozen instead of fresh. And, you know, the things that these people deal with on a daily basis. And then at 5 o'clock, the doors open and we're on. And it's pretty remarkable. And I think that Anthony Bourdain, I think, kind of was the first celebrity to show this is how the restaurants really are. It's not this, you know, this easy thing to produce every night. It's very difficult, and it's very stressful, but it's amazing when you see it in action.
Yeah, I read once that you said that the restaurant will take on the soul of the person who's attached to it.
Yes, so, I believe that.
Yeah, so you put a lot of soul, and you put yourself into it.
I did, and that's kind of how the music and the playlist came about, because when we first opened, I just went to Pandora and, you know, restaurant jazz or something like that, and then kind of rethought it, and I looked at my restaurant and said, you know, this is kind of me, and it's my food, and I want to hear my music, and hopefully other people will like my music, and let's do that. So I made a playlist that was people seem to like, and now I'm 10 playlists in, and I'm very passionate about those and kind of obsessive about those, and it's the source of a lot of jokes with my staff, and I always say it's great to get compliments on the food, but when I get compliments on the playlist, that's great.
That's great.
Are they seasonal as well? Do you have seasonal playlists?
They are not. They are
food as well.
They are not seasonal. Nope. You know, the reason we have 10 of them is so that you're not hearing the same songs over and over. There's no single song on two playlists, so each one gets a little more difficult to make. And they're all put in order so that at the end of the night there's a little more energy, kind of with the cooks in mind, to get them through the last push. And so it's a lot of fun. It's just another aspect of Tavola that I think is very positive.
And do you have seasonal or not, but do you have a favorite protein that you like to work with or a favorite spice? Is any of that important to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I love to cook really classic food, and, you know, I'll even something simple as a fish and chips, I'll read everything I can about fish and chips from England to New England to Ireland to... And then at the end of the week, I'll come up with a recipe and make fish and chips for my kids, you know, and myself or my wife. And so that's just an example. But I think being from New England, seafood is probably lobster. I love to cook lobster. And so I would probably say seafood in general is, the you know, what I like to cook most of all. But I think my favorite meal of all, it would be a nice big bowl of pasta with meatballs, sausage, and a nice bottle of Brunello.
Is there a place that you want to travel to, or maybe that you've been to, that is inspirational to your cooking?
Well, I went to Italy for the first time since the restaurant opened this past summer, and it was very inspirational. And I got a very good sense of kind of what we're doing and what owning an Italian restaurant is about. And it was a great experience.
What stands out to you specifically?
I think that just the tradition, you know, and how this food is respected and handed down from, you know, grandmother to son to his son. And it's just, you know, it doesn't change. I didn't get a lot of people trying to do something different or trying to reinvent something. It was very a lot of pride and just a lot of tradition, and I really spoke to me.
Michael, do you bring any of the kitchen stuff that you do at Tavola home? Do you cook at home with that intensity, or are you know what I'm saying? So go ahead.
I do, and more so now that I'm not cooking behind the line every night. I tend to cook more at home. Whether it's my kid's favorite, which is my homemade chicken fingers, or, you know, me and my wife making a chicken mole. And it's just, like I said, you know, I'll do research for a week and really get into... Lately, I bought a paella grill kit, and so I've been making paellas. And so it's... Yeah, I really enjoy cooking at home, and... you know, not so much what I'm cooking at the restaurant. I kind of like to stray from that a little bit when I'm at home.
Well, thank you so much.
Have chicken fingers on the menu.
My kids tried to get to make that happen at the beginning.
I can imagine.
Did they really?
Yeah, my son wrote a kids menu for me. And I was like, God, this would be harder to execute than our menu.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I'd love to see that. And I'd love to come.
I still have it.
Oh, good. Yeah. I was there recently. I should say it was fabulous. I was there at a really large table of people, and it was amazing. And the vibe is, as Michael Kevney describes, really great.
Thank
you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in a minute, we're going to talk with Tracy Howe. But first, we have a news of note from Nancy Lawrence.
Oh, we do. We do. Yes. While the White House has been doing what they do with prisons, they're also polluting the oceans while we weren't looking. On Wednesday, this White House has repealed our national ocean policy, in essence saying that our oceans exist solely as a source of profit for the oil industry and other polluters. You know, he's already expanded offshore oil drilling, withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord, is also attempting right now to revoke protections for Arctic and marine monuments, is ignoring legal obligations to protect West Coast endangered marine species, and now this. But this executive order abandons ocean conservation, coastal protections, and the coastal communities that rely on these clean seas. Like, they bring the seafood to Michael. Industries are now free to operate with little meaningful oversight, and of course, it is up to us, to the local governments and communities, to protect our oceans. What do you got? And I have to say, of course, he is undoing an Obama policy. There you go. Okay, mm-hmm. What do you got?
Of course. I always say this at the end, but now I'm going to have to say it's now. No one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. This is, you know, just a national nightmare. And a new Pew poll showed that interest in the upcoming election is up more than it has been in at least 20 years. So hopefully that's a positive thing for Democrats. But pick something and do something. My news of note is related to what's going on at the border. From the academic journal Criminology, reported by the Washington Post, states with larger shares of undocumented immigrants tended to have lower crime rates than states with smaller shares in the years 1990 to 2014. And then increases in the undocumented immigration population within states are associated with significant decreases in the prevalence of violence. So there's more. Cato Institute, same kind of thing. Undocumented immigrants commit less crime than native-born citizens. Preaching to the choir, but it's good to have the facts and get someone, maybe someone who didn't vote last time, to vote.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, he's so busy focusing on the wrong people. He's just making us less safe, obviously, by doing what he's doing, and everyone hates us, and we're creating terrorists here and there for, you know, there's just... Yeah.
Yes. So on a happy note, we have a musician here and an activist.
Go segue, Ellen, go.
Yes. And she's amazing. And we're going to hear more and learn more about her. Tracy Howe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you both.
Yes. So Tracy is a recording artist. I'm going to do your introduction now. She uses her music to communicate struggle and hope, beauty and brokenness. It's a combination of electroacoustic pop and social gospel soul. She's also the founder of Restoration Village Arts, a retreat, learning, and action community for artists and ministers who work to achieve racial justice, justice for the environment, queer justice, and also borderlands justice. How apropos. So welcome to the show once again, Tracy. So I wanted to ask you, what inspires and drives you, because you're a very, you know, I would say deep, for lack of a better word, person with a lot of interests in justice for the world. What inspires and drives you to create this music?
Thank you for that question. And thank you also for drawing attention to these very painful and also so urgent issues and happenings in our world right now. I think what drives me is this belief that our humanity can still be cultivated in the midst of these things. I think I've experienced that myself, the cultivation of my own humanity, the more that I understand how the machinations of the world have really diminished our humanity. And so, you know, even talking about the crisis that exists today, we know that this didn't just suddenly occur, that even under the previous administration, there was a horrible crisis of deportation and dehumanization. And we know that it didn't start with the last administration. We know that the militarization of our border happened in 94 with the coinciding with the North American Free Trade Agreement, which devastated local economies throughout Central America. It allowed for a new degree of ecological and destruction and extraction in a really exploitative way. And we know that that wasn't the start of it, that even prior to that, there were doctrines in effect that allowed us to put mobilize dehumanizing ideology and destructive and violent economies. So when I look at the current crisis and the complexity, it is very overwhelming. I appreciate what you said, Ellen, that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And I would also maybe suggest or encourage people that the way we might find a sustainable way out of this, a way that we might find a justice that is not just a policy that we can affect for the next, 4 to 8 years that automatically bounces back, that we also need to be doing the cultural work alongside of this so that the policy will be sustaining. So that's a lot of what I see my work being, both as a minister and as an artist and a musician, is to accompany the systemic justice work, the policy outcomes, the education, with cultural work that will hopefully sustain it. And I think what I am recognizing, even just in the last couple of months, as I've been reflecting and thinking of new ways, I have several friends on the border who are camped out at different detention centers in Tornillo, which is, we've seen the aerial photos of the children in the tent cities, and then also in Arizona and Oregon, who are following it and just holding vigil and reminding everybody that there's a humanity at stake right now. But culturally, what is it that prevents us from creating any kind of sustainable change, that we can literally have an administration that sets all these things in motion and then it just is all undone seemingly in the blink of an eye?
So we have to go to a hard break, but we're going to come right back. Really interesting, talking about a sustainable way out in this cultural work. This is Tracy Howe, musician, activist, founder of Restoration Village Arts. We'll be right back after this. It's Apropos of Something. We're on 947WPVC.org, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Today we are talking with Tracy Howe. We were talking with Michael Kevney. You can catch the podcast, WPVC.org, 947, in front of that. All our podcasts are there. So, Tracy, we were talking about sustaining what's, the cultural, maybe a revolution, but what do you mean by cultural change when you talk about that?
Cultural work, yeah. It's something that I'm learning and experiencing in real time. But what I recognize is that what runs our society is systems and put in place and sustained by policies. But what allowed this to come to life were the underlying symbols and ideologies and beliefs. And in order to engage at this level, you need cultural workers, and artists would be at the forefront of that. People in food, I think, are cultural workers, faith communities, but also people just who are working with public symbols. So to bring this really close to home in Charlottesville, we continue to see the unfolding of stories around our monuments in public. And if we backtrack to over a year ago when those debates were ongoing and the Blue Ribbon Commission was doing its work to uncover the full history of race and the full story of these monuments. When the question arose, what should we do about them? Some came from a very practical economic standpoint. It would cost X amount of dollars to take them down, and we could do X amount of good for our community with those dollars. So that's a legitimate argument. But when we talk about the culture and what is going to sustain a story that is, we all can hold the fullness of both the pain and the beauty of the story, we need symbols in our public spaces to reflect that. And if that's the case, then the statue is a symbol that upholds a belief. And the way that we would deal with that in different cultures or in different faith traditions is maybe to repent, to repair, to take it down, to turn towards another life-giving way. So now when we turn to the border and we look at these dehumanizing things that continue, or the ecological devastation that Nancy also talked about in the news of note, culturally, something that we have to look out for, especially if we are people of privilege and power, people politically who are white, who have access to this privilege and power, is that we are so saturated by this idea of individualism that it can actually stress us out, this overwhelming, we have to do good, do goodery. But the danger with that is we can always opt out. So I'm not, you know, this idea of charity and do-goodery and just do more and more activism, I don't find as sustainable. And I wonder if we need another word. And I've been contemplating and speaking to others about the need to talk about collective responsibility. Responsibility is something that entangles us. We can't get away from it. And so if we talk about collective responsibility of this migrant crisis, that's different than, oh, we just must do something because people are suffering. That can be a gateway drug, and I'm all for people just doing something because they have this, this reaction of compassion. But ultimately, to be sustainable, we need to see ourselves in the same story, entangled with these people who are crossing the border. And I think that there's a side that's also hopeful, and that is if we accept collective responsibility, we can activate beyond our individual capacity. We can activate as in a collective response ability. And we've seen that in the ways that communities are surrounding detention centers and making demands and just being physically present in mass. Today is actually the culmination of the Poor People's Campaign, 40 days of nonviolent direct action. The Poor People's Campaign, of course, was something Martin Luther King set in motion before his assassination, and has been picked up now by a number of people. But they're culminating 40 days of direct action with direct action right now in D.C., to address intersectionally systemic racism, ecological devastation, poverty, and the war economy.
Hey, Tracy, the company, it's not a company, the organization, Restoration Village Arts, that you founded as a response to this, essentially, I'll say, this government and its policies, has the Village Arts changed it, the way that it, does it partner more? Does it, you know, do you change the way you engage with actions that you want to take?
That's a great question. I would hope not, just because when you're rooted, to keep from being reactionary, you have to stay rooted in something that is always the case. And so our ultimate drive is to see a just and beautiful world. And for me, justice and beauty are very connected. Again, justice might be that that level of good that is just meeting a need, but beauty is both the fruit of and catalyst for transforming things and changing things. And so it can adapt to different situations that arrive in different complexities. I do think that our projects are a direct manifestation of the crises that have emerged in the last year. But we've tried to create something that draws attention to the intersections of all issues and can mobilize artists and cultural workers most effectively where they are located. So, you know, one of the projects this last year was helping to launch Congregate, which organized people of faith here in Charlottesville prior to and during, and then has continued to organize people against white supremacy and to mobilize people of faith and conscience in Charlottesville, and of course facilitated the national call last year at August 12th. So obviously that project arose directly as a result of the story going on in Charlottesville. And again, I do think that the rhetoric might have, you know, the rhetoric is emboldened. White supremacist, explicit white supremacist rhetoric is emboldened by this white supremacist administration. But this administration didn't create white supremacy or the racism in Charlottesville, if that. So, yes, it's all related, but yes and no.
Where are you, or unless going backwards is the better answer, but where have you been or where are you going with the activism and outreach you're doing? What's on your schedule?
Sure. Yeah. So the people that I work with, many different colleagues, you know, we are talking about the border. We are talking about physically going to some detention centers. It's hard to know where we might have impact, though, because there's always, when you're in activist communities, you're always working with local people who live there, who are dedicated to the long-term work. And sometimes in my world, we call it public witness. You're bearing witness to something and trying to, again, cultivate humanity, reminding people of their humanity. But you really have to be sensitive to, you know, the last thing we would want to do is go stand vigil at a detention center and actually, you know, put the children there at more danger of being, you know, pushed somewhere else to a military base we don't have access to or something like that. So there's ongoing kind of conversations about how to best be present, how to best pressure the administration, lawmakers, but also state. We've been seeing really amazing things happen at state levels with governors saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We need to know what's going on. Even airlines refusing to be complicit, those kinds of things. So I'm involved in all those conversations, and I love the U.S.-Mexico border for the culture and beauty and resilience that I witnessed there, and how that geographic region has helped me cultivate my own humanity over decades. But I hope that whether I'm able to physically go or not, that people continue to be active in that. I actually have the chance to go to Hawaii for a couple of weeks. There's a gathering of youth associated with the denomination that I serve nationally, who are gathering to learn about the convergence of their beliefs, community building, justice, and issues. And Hawaii, actually, you know, as a part of the United States, has such a unique cross-section of things that affect it, impact it, as well as the culture that is unique and flows out of it. So I'm really excited about that. They're focusing on water. Hawaii is at the front lines of climate change in a lot of ways, but also indigenous rights, sovereign rights, and all the continuing things. And personally, I'm really looking forward to going, because my ancestry is Southeast Asian and European primarily, and my father was born in the Philippines, and there are a lot of Filipinos in Hawaii. So I'm really looking forward to that kind of personal connection and learning a little bit more about my ancestry as well.
We're talking with Tracy Howe. We're talking about cultivating humanity, collective responsibility. A lot of this is very inspirational and hopeful in the face of all this trauma that we're experiencing, and also, you know, that we're witnessing. If people, what can you recommend if people actually want to get involved with Restoration Village Arts? I know you have social media presence at Rest Village Arts, and also at Tracy Howe Music with an E. Are there things, or do you have suggestions for people who want to learn more about your work?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for that. I'm going to be really honest and say after, you know, the year we've had in Charlottesville, we have just been exhausted. we're all traumatized. We're all trying to, and the story is still unfolding. And so I thank people for coming and checking out those links and those social media platforms. But we really are trying to amplify the voices of others right now that are at the front lines of all these things we're talking about, amplifying the voices of our friends and partners in terms of Restoration Village Arts as a small institution, be it a small one, a proverbial wagon, so to speak, or perhaps maybe a tent. You know, we're still very much engaged in the ongoing activism here in Charlottesville around racial justice and trying to prevent. I mean, we're seeing a lot of weaponization of our court system by the white supremacists towards activists. And, you know, the anniversary of August 12th is right around the corner. So that's where our focus is right now.
Well, before I know Ellen's going to be saying goodbye shortly, but before we do, Tracy, what can you tell us about your new album? Let's at least begin, end where we started this. What's going on with your new album? What can you share?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you. So I released Bring Me Some Peace August last year, just less than 2 weeks after August 12th, which both was really hard promotion-wise, just, you know, it was all very muddy water. Trying to release this music in the wake of something so violent. But the music itself, I think, is actually something that calls us to build community, to activate our humanity, and to heal from those things that diminish humanity. And so in that sense, it was really timely, and I continue to share about that music. I just put it on SoundCloud so that you can stream it in its entirety for free. So I hope people check out Bring Me Some Peace at Tracy Howe Music on SoundCloud. But this album I just recorded in Memphis in February, I'm hoping to release before the end of the year, called Things That Grow, has really grown out of the movement work that I've done with communities and alongside people over the last 3 years. It has woven into it struggles for racial justice, but from a lens of people who are trying to liberate themselves from the dehumanizing force of what whiteness is, what it means to be socialized white, and reconnect with people, a greater story than being white in the United States. It also has stories of just the power of beauty and what the symbol and hope a garden is.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for this tremendous work you're doing to promote justice for the marginalized, imperiled, persecuted groups, helping protect our environment and fighting systems of oppression locally here in Charlottesville and also nationally. Thanks for being here, Tracy.
Thank you.
Hey, Nancy.
Yeah.
You know what it's time for? The palate cleanser. What do you have?
Oh, okay. All right. So the summer heat can be oppressive. Obviously, this White House can be definitely oppressive. So here's a suggestion to chill out, pun intended. If you have an ice cream maker, if you're one that makes ice cream and you want to add alcohol to it because of the above, helpful tip I've discovered. For a standard quart of ice cream base, don't add more than 5 or 6 tablespoons of 80 proof liquor. And the reason is because alcohol lowers an ice cream's freezing and melting point. So a too boozy ice cream will melt in your mouth, in a bowl, in the freezer. It's going to get ice crystals. You won't be able to scoop it, all of that. So don't go nuts when you need the
that's
combo.
So
and if you don't feel like making any because, you know, you're not Martha Stewart or whatever, if you're not Ben or Jerry, there are companies that make booze-infused ice cream like a Tipsy Scoop. Cake Batter Vodka Martini is one of them. Anyway,
that's great.
What do you got?
That really made me laugh. Also food-related, German chocolate cake is named after a guy named Sam German, not the country. M&M's stand for Mars and Murray. The names of two people who invented the chocolate candy. That's what I have for my palate cleanser. So Yours was, I love yours. Mine were just like quickies. But next week, I wanted to mention that we're going to have a special guest who's been with us before, Jim Cohn, psychology professor, and he has been talking with experts on the effects of this immigration policy on, you know, on the children. On at the border and beyond, he's going to talk with us next week. And also Matt Rohde, he is an expert on cyber currency, and you may know him also as the owner of Carpe Donut. So we're going to break down what cyber currency is and what Bitcoin is, because it's hard to wrap your head around. So also wanted to mention that our theme music is by Springtide. Thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you, Nancy, as well.
Thank you, Ellen.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham Team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.